And a good morning. Local time is 8:06. I'm Bill Skinner with your KPCW Local News Hour, filling in for Roger this morning. Well, it's looking like we could have some weather changes on the way this weekend. Let's find out what's in store for us with ABC4 Weather's Cedric Haynes.
Happy Black Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for your Friday for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at partly sunny skies turning to mostly cloudy skies this afternoon. Could have a slight chance of a couple of isolated snow showers or rain showers developing late this evening here as a weak front moves through the area. The bigger story will be the colder air that moves in behind this front as we go throughout your day on your Saturday. We're looking at partly cloudy skies. It will be dry Saturday, but highs will only be in the 30s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 40s in the Heber Valley. As we get towards your Saturday night, we're looking at clouds thickening back up again across the area. Temperatures will dip down into the mid-20s in Park City. We'll see those temperatures dipping into the low to mid-20s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Sunday, snow will become likely for both the Wasatch Back, and that does include Park City and the Heber Valley. We're looking at that chance of accumulating snow developing throughout the day. Temperatures will only be warming up to around freezing in Park City and just above freezing in the Heber Valley. Now, we will have that chance of seeing some accumulations with this snow activity as it moves on through. Right now, it's looking like the potential of 1 to 3 inches of snow, not the blockbuster storm, but a storm that could provide a little snow cover to the area. As we go into Sunday night, that snow will begin to taper off from north to south across the area as temperatures dip back down into the teens across the region. Heading into next week on your Monday, look for mostly sunny skies. We'll see those high temperatures only around the freezing mark across the area, so that cold air will stay in place, and that could set the stage for another potential weather maker moving in Tuesday into Wednesday. Details still murky with that system, but we could see another chance of some wintry weather building back in as high temperatures will remain into the 30s through the middle of next week with lows into the 20s there for the Wasatch Back. As we get towards the end of the week, there's a potential of even one more storm system rolling through sometime towards the end of the week or into next weekend. So an active, wetter, and colder pattern on the way for the Wasatch Back. For the Wasatch Back forecast, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, Mayor-elect Ryan Dickey joins us in studio to share his election journey and what he plans to do during his 4 years in office. Then we'll hear from University of Utah marketing professor Alyssa Wu, who gives some insights into evolving holiday shopping trends. And Jessica Moran from the PC Mark tells us how to work off your Thanksgiving feast with the Holiday Fitness Challenge that starts next week. Then stay tuned for the community campfire at 9 a.m., this week, Amber Johnson hops on the famed Heber Valley Railroad for a behind-the-scenes look at the festive North Pole Express. Then we'll hear from Patricia Gomes, who took up hockey on her 60th birthday, and we'll do a deep dive into Arlo Guthrie's cultural Thanksgiving staple, Alice's Restaurant, which has been played on KPCW since the early 80s. That's the community campfire. Turning now to some local news, the Heber City Council voted 3-2 to support a tax increment funding plan for Station 7, a mixed-use development planned near Smith's Marketplace. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Heber City's Community Reinvestment Agency, or CRA, is meant to spur downtown revitalization. The plan relies on tax-sharing agreements to help finance new development in the city. Local governments participating in the CRA agree to defer some of their tax revenue from new property value in the area for a set amount of time. That increment is used to pay for redevelopment projects. At a city council meeting November 18th, the developers of Station 7 won leaders' support to use tax increment financing for their planned mixed-use village. The development, formerly known as New London, will sit north of Smith's Marketplace. The developers say the CRA will help them build a higher quality project with a hotel, parking garage, and extensive community gathering spaces. Those amenities would be in addition to residential and commercial development that's planned either way. Without the CRA, the developers estimate the city will receive around $6 million in revenue over 30 years. With the tax increment, Heber's estimated revenue would be about $16 million. The council disagreed about how much benefit Station 7 could offer the city. Councilmember Scott Phillips said he thinks Station 7 will be an amazing investment in Heber's future.
Just with the addition of Deer Valley East Village, when people are starting to book their winter trips, they're looking into Wasatch County as well. So there is a need for this type of thing, and I don't know anybody in town that doesn't want more restaurants.
Councilmember Sid Ostergaard said he'd like to explore more ways to mitigate the traffic impact of the development, like partnering with High Valley Transit and making developments more walkable.
That's the only way we can reduce, you know, if we have that public transit, that's how we're going to reduce cars.
Councilmember Yvonne Barney said she was not willing to vote yes on the project. She argued the CRA is meant for Central Heber, not the area around Smiths.
I know that in your mind, because you are developers, this is fantastic. You benefit from this. You say we benefit from this. I don't think we benefit from this as citizens. I think you're asking us to reach deep into these shallow pockets and hand you more money.
Tax increment financing only reallocates revenue generated by new growth. The city would keep 100% of its existing tax base. Councilmember Mike Johnston said the project will benefit Heber's overall economic development, especially if it includes components like a parking garage. Heber leaders have said creating more parking infrastructure is one of their top goals to make it easier for residents to visit shops, restaurants, and events downtown.
I believe what you're doing here is a very good thing for our downtown. It's a significant good thing, and I really like it.
Johnston made a motion for the council, acting as the CRA board, to support the project. The vote was 3-2, with Barney and Councilmember Aaron Cheatwood dissenting. Later, the developers will need to get the specifics of their project approved by the city council. Station 7 is also looking for tax increment financing support from Wasatch County and the county school board. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Torfler, KPCW News.
Well, first up today, KPCW's Roger Goldman had the opportunity to sit down with Mayor-elect Ryan Dickey to reflect on the campaign and to look ahead to what's next. Here's that conversation.
The Park City Mayor's race finally came to a conclusion on Monday when Ryan Dickey was declared the winner by a narrow 7-vote margin after a recount. Interestingly enough, the recount margin was exactly the same as the original count. Ryan joins us in the studio this morning. Morning, Ryan. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
So, Ryan, this was a long campaign. Let's talk a little bit. I don't know if people really understand the scope of what it means to have run for mayor. How many homes did you visit, and how many people do you think you talked to?
Well, that's a great question. I think between my campaign team and I, we knocked on, I think, just close to 1,000 doors, and I knocked on most of those myself. So a true door-knocking effort like you would expect to see in a local campaign. Met a lot of people, and the door knocking experience was great. I have to admit, it's something that before the campaign wasn't at the top of my list of things I was looking forward to, my new door to door sales job. But it turns out, I mean, people were extremely polite. You'd knock on a door and they'd tell you they're undecided, which usually meant they were voting for Jack, but are too polite to tell you, or they would tell you they support you, or they had genuine questions. Only had one door really closed in my face. Everybody else wanted to talk. And that was another great thing. People in Park City answer the door, and they want to talk to you. They want to hear about what's going on. People are engaged. So the door-to-door experience was actually one of my favorite parts of the campaign.
This was significantly more than what you did when you ran for council last time.
Yeah, I knocked on some doors when I ran for council, but it's just a different lift. The dynamics of that race were different. Running for mayor, people take that role really seriously. They look at it. We'll probably talk a little bit about the job of the mayor, but even beyond the mayor's duty, I think they sort of look at who the mayor is as sort of a bellwether of where we are as a town. So there's a lot of sort of signifying that goes on with who the mayor is, and so they're really interested to go deep with you in a way that was a little bit different from the city council campaign.
How long ago did you start knocking on doors?
I think I started knocking on doors in late August, okay. I want to say.
So between the physical door knocking and the various meet and greets, this was taking up most of your life over the last 6 months, I assume.
It did. There was a point in, I think in mid-July, where I looked at my wife and I said, I think this is my full-time job here for, through the campaign. It does become all-consuming. For the most part, it's a really positive experience. So my kids love being involved in it. You go to people's houses and, they do meet and greets for you. And what that involves is basically, having a glass of wine with a bunch of neighbors and talking about a bunch of stuff that I love to talk about. So, meeting new people, overwhelmingly just a very positive experience. Of course, you are adding a a new job to your plate of running a campaign. There are the logistics and the mailing lists and, you know, all the to-dos of running a campaign that are that can be drudgery. And, you know, there's the downside of the campaign and the online stuff and all that. But overwhelmingly still felt very local and very positive.
And we could touch on some of the unpleasantness, which is a little bit unusual for a Park City campaign. Where do you think it was coming from?
You know, I think social media is just, it's sort of the new world we live in, and it seems like, you know, the campaign 4 years ago felt like it was about as tough as it could get, and I think most people felt like this one online was, you know, even tougher. So I think just the anonymity of being online, and sometimes folks just communicating in a way online that they wouldn't in person. You know, it's something that we, you know, something that we got to work on as a community. But that's a national problem too. It does end up feeling a little more personal when it's so close to home.
And you've been in public life for a while. You were on the planning commission. You've been on city council. But this was a more intense experience in terms of interacting with voters. What are three things you learned that either surprised you or that they just were different as a result of all this contact that you had with your voters?
Wow. Well, you learn so much and you learn something at every door. I mean, one thing is, you know, like I said, that people are generally very polite, very nice, and really, really happy with the city. People love living here. And so that makes us a very positive community. I think we feel that out on our trails and walking down Main Street. I think we all pat ourselves on the back a little bit to say, I can't believe we get to live here.
What is that t-shirt? If you're lucky enough to live here, you're lucky enough.
Yeah, that's right. If your garage is your trailhead, you're in good shape. At the same time, that makes it really hard to talk about changing anything. We live in a community where people, most of us weren't born here. It's a community of choice that we decided to come to. And so a lot of people here could have lived just about anywhere. And they chose this place because it just really is exactly what they wanted. And so when you start talking about changing it, they get probably justifiably a little nervous. So that, I think, really runs through all of the issues from, you know, to traffic and growth and really everything else. I think people really start from this place of I chose to live here and I really love it how it is. So there's two sides to that coin. I think you definitely learned all politics is local. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a flavor of sort of partisanship that ended up, you know, running through the election, especially at the end. You know, the local you know, parties ended up endorsing. And when you look at the results of the campaign, I don't think they cut along partisan lines. It really sort of, you know, broke with this housing project at Clark Ranch and people really sort of voting on, you know, what's really happening, you know, in their backyard and down
literally.
The street. Yeah, literally in their backyard. And I saw that too. You know, when you knock on doors, of course, you know, now in our connected world, we have all sorts of data about who's going to be opening the door and who lives there and what political party might they be. And so when you knock on that door, especially when I first started door knocking, you have an expectation. Okay, well, here's a house of five Republicans or four Democrats or independents or one of these, you know, small parties in Utah. And I saw almost no correlation between political party and the conversations that we had. Like the issues that are important to voters are the same. Their concerns are the same. Really doesn't matter what their party is. They want to talk about traffic. They want to talk about growth and the workforce and the resorts. And in a way, it made me feel good about the state of the country. I think we have this view that we're so divided. And what I found in, you know, peeking behind the curtain, so many doors in Park City, is that we really all want the same things. We want the same things for our family and for our kids, and we have similar concerns. We're human beings that all chose to live in this place together. We're very much wired the same, you know, probably on a species level. We just can't be all that much different. And I'd see two houses next door to each other, you know, max partisan in either direction, and think, yeah, I hope we're getting together for a barbecue and having some wine, because if they could probably spend 30 minutes around a table together, they could probably work out some compromise on our national issues and move things forward.
There's a wonderful scene in the Robert Redford film, The Candidate, where after he has won the election, he kind of looks at the camera and goes, "Now what?" So I want to talk a little bit about now what, Ryan. Help our listeners understand a little bit about the role of the mayor in the structure of our government and the challenges that's going to present for you to try to execute on a vision.
Yeah, so you know, the mayor is the chief executive of the city, and that's a big job, and it has a lot that goes with it. At the same time, I think as a community, we invest so much in our mayoral election because we think of it sort of like a presidential election, and that analogy really doesn't hold. In fact, one of the hardest parts about deciding to run for mayor was knowing that I'd be giving up my vote on council. So the mayor really doesn't vote. The mayor plays this leadership role in the region with the state. The mayor leads the council. So in a way, the mayor brings a lot of vision and can apply a lot of leadership and definitely from a policy perspective, sort of be picking your spots. But what you're really doing is facilitating the council and getting the council's vision across the finish line. So that, you know, you're, as the mayor, you're the only person with on council. You are a member of the council with an office in the city. I'm going to be sitting next door to that city manager. And so I'll be the person who is looking at this broad set of issues, things that are sitting before us, all these opportunities we have, and really figuring out how to harness the organization, work with our city manager, our city attorney, our staff, get our council together to try to corral us into a unified vision on these so many of these issues and push it forward. So it's really a leadership role. It's not as much of a policy, thumbs up, thumbs down vote on this or any issue. That's the fun part of the job. I mean, that's what I'm.
That's why you wanted to do it.
That's why I wanted to do it.
So it's an agenda-setting role. It's a leadership role. In other words, it's an opportunity to try to create a place for policy to move forward. But you got to get the council to buy into it, or nothing's going to happen.
That's right. And so you have to figure out what do these five people need. We have council members who are who have continuity. We will have two brand new council members. What do they need? You know, we all campaign, and you have your laundry list of issues. But what is truly important to these council members from a policy perspective? And what do they need? How do you work with them? How do you bring a team together? You know, I've led a lot of teams. I actually love that part of leadership. Of sort of having a team coalesce, coming through that sort of storming and norming phase, and figuring out a way to work as a team. That'll be a big part of what we do early in the year, especially as we appoint a new city council member and figure out how what's important. I mean, one thing we've done, I think, as a city is we've had so many priorities, so much going on. I learned that in the campaign, that freaks our citizens, our residents out a little bit. There's so much going on. It can feel like so much change. And it makes it difficult to get things across the finish line, too. So what as a council is a short list of things that are really important and achievable that we can push over the finish line.
Two big appointments coming up, city manager and the new council member. Talk a little bit about the city manager role. What is your sort of three bullet points of what you're looking for in a new city manager?
Yeah, for me, it's the two are, I think, a track record, and I said this throughout the campaign, just a track record of organizational leadership. Someone who has really shown they can sort of take the reins of an organization and build culture, rebuild a little bit of culture. I think I want to see us shift our culture a little bit to empower our staff to take some more risks, sort of let our staff take chances and even fail from time to time and have not be the sort of the end of the world. Really a little more of a culture of risk-taking, because I've seen when our staff does feel supported and empowered, they do great work and they get excited. It's mission-driven people who want to come work in government. They don't come for the money. And so how do we build a culture that really supports team building and empowering folks to just go work on these big ideas and fulfill the reason they entered this career path in the first place. So organizational leadership. Then the second piece is I do expect to find someone with experience in government that really understands how government works. I don't know if that's mandatory. I think leadership can come from a lot of different places. But Park City is a complicated place to begin with. I can tell you the politics of Norfolk Avenue and American Sadler, 2 miles away. I mean, you find very different issues. The politics are very micro. I think understanding how government works is probably a pretty good foundation for leading the city.
And the timeline, when do you think that, what's the goal to have that hiring done by?
Well, I think we'll probably hire that, we'll probably extend offers and end of February. I'm guessing that's going to be the timeline, and we'll see where we end up.
And again, the council process, which I believe you went through at one time, being selected as a council member.
I did.
So you're very familiar with that process. Again, what's the timeline for that?
So somewhere near the beginning of January, we'll interview for, they'll just be, it's sort of like a planning commission appointment where Annie will be able to apply. We'll have an application and an interview process. You know, we'll probably spend 20, 30 minutes per candidate in a public meeting, so the public will get to see those interviews. Works a little bit different from a board and commission appointment, and that it's not the advice and consent of the mayor. It's actually the council who will pick their colleague, and the mayor would break a tie. So I'll lead that interview process, but ultimately it's council that will fill the vacancy.
Again, just like some of the other things, you're setting the table, but you don't get to eat.
That's right. That's right.
Unless there's dessert.
I get to live with their choice.
Exactly. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about some of the big issues that have lingered and what your vision is as to how you're going to get them across the finish line. 5 acres.
Sure.
How are you going to get that done?
You know, this is one of my goals. You know, I've tried not to use the word, you know, first 100 days. I've been around long enough to know that the speed of government sometimes is not 100 days. But that's one where I think within this first part of the year, we'll have a clear project vision before us that is sort of the best version of this sort of art-centric, mixed-use, housing, public space project. That we're going to have that will at least allow us to say, hey, this is something that we as a council and community want on these 5 acres, and let's go. That's the decision, and it's made. Or to say, this isn't it, and you know, we want a park, or it's something else, or it's land banking, or some type of pause. What I've really said during the campaign is, I think the idea of a 5 acre park is fantastic. I think that mixed-use, arts-centric, public gathering space plaza is fantastic. I'm game for anything, Roger, other than what it is today. So my legacy, in 4 years, if we are looking at that same plot of dirt with nothing happening, it's just completely unacceptable. So we just got to get to a decision, and I want that decision soon in my first year.
I wanted to talk about that mostly as to raise the question of, what do you think we've learned about the role of the city as a developer? Is this something that the city, that you think a municipality can do in an efficient and effective way?
Well, I think we've learned that the city is not a great developer. And that's coming from, you know, my first day on council. I think we knew that. I don't think that's a revelation of mine. And you see that in our affordable housing strategy. We know that we're good at setting a policy priority, having some land that can be difficult or not as difficult to build on, and then recruiting a private developer to help us get projects done. And that's actually the strategy that we have on the 5 acre too. So, you know, we had an RFP, we have a private developer. Still a frustrating process to have 5 members of a city council and a mayor trying to develop 5 acres together from the dais. It's not my view of probably the best way to develop real estate. So that's been a tough process to be a part of. But ultimately, you know, the city does have to set policy priorities and for the land that it owns. The alternative is not own the land at all. It's easy to sort of forget. I think people's memory tends to sort of go back to the Arts and Culture District and not go back just a little bit further to why we purchased the land at all, which was not for an Arts and Culture District, but to actually extinguish, you know, high-density nightly rental development. So we sort of did that successfully. I think there's been conversation about what the price was. Looking back, any real estate you bought in 2017 is a bargain today. But, you know, so we sort of mission accomplished on day one. So the question since then is, what is now the strategic purpose of this land? And it seems like we've been struggling a little bit to, put together a strategy since then. But we got to figure it out, because the current state is just not acceptable. I mean, my wife drives by it too many times a day, and I talk to her too many times a day to have this continue, because I hear about it at home. So we're going to do something.
I don't see a world in which eventually there isn't some kind of remote catch basin, for lack of a better term, for cars. Sooner or later, it's going to have to happen. How is that something that you would hope to accomplish by the end of your term, not necessarily having it completely implemented, but at least having an agreed upon design for how we're going to get that done?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the other piece when I look at what's the near term stuff, whether we're calling 100 days or 125 days. We have the opportunity sitting before us to capture cars before they come into town. We need to pick a park and ride site. We know that's going to be Richardson Flat or it's going to be Gordo. You know, in all likelihood, our Recreate 248 study is coming to a close here, and we'll be able to make that decision and push that forward. So there's been talk about that with the 5 acres. I'm less excited about bringing cars into town and creating more traffic. But we can pick that site and move that forward. You know, we're way in front of the Olympic planning timeline. Like, I've said, if you go back to the 2002 timeline, we're still 2.5 years away from the games even being awarded. So we're way out in front of this thing in the Olympics. And Recreate 248, though, is something that is Olympics planning. This is infrastructure that is going to serve our needs for the Olympics. We think it's going to integrate into the partnership we have with Deer Valley. Like, this is a big thing happening and absolutely a near-term incumbent thing for us to get this over the line.
And you mentioned the Olympic infrastructure. I suppose that at least raises the potential for some financial help.
Absolutely. It's not necessarily IOC money, but it gets us to the front of the line for transportation
UDOT
grants.
With
UDOT and FTA. So that's where we can tap into that money from the Olympics.
You used the word legacy a few minutes ago, and I want you to preview an interview that I want to do with you at the end of your term, in which you list for me the 3 accomplishments that you managed to do during term. I'm going to set you up. What are the 3 things you want to have done that would cause you to think this was a success, even if you only got 1 or 2 of them?
Sure. The list is actually probably long, so I'll be careful in trying to pick them. And as I stall for time with these words while I think about what to say, but I'll tell you the things that are really important. We talked about 5 acre. We're going to have a decision on 5 acre, and that's going to be a completely different site at the end of my term. We will have broken ground, I would hope, or certainly making significant progress on the Fed timeline for that piece of regional transportation infrastructure outside of town. And then Olympics planning more broadly at the end of 4 years, we're going to be able to look at it and know that we're on a path to having a phenomenal Olympics in Utah and specifically here in Park City. You know, the Olympics talk can get a little mundane because so much of it is about transportation, and it's about things that we know we need, and we're planning for the time beyond the Olympics, not just the Olympics, sure. But there's this other piece of Olympics planning that is the sizzle of the Olympics. That is, what's the cool stuff we want to do? What are we going to do on Main Street? You know, in 2002, you know, we were the party. Park City put ourselves on the map. And so we have that same opportunity beyond $100 million infrastructure projects to say, hey, let's have a killer Olympics in Park City. And what are the things we need to do to make it memorable and fun for everyone who lives here today and our kids and this next generation that'll be here in 2034?
Ryan Dickey, thanks. First of all, congratulations on a campaign that took a long time but ended up, the way you wanted it to.
Yes.
And good luck on your new tenure.
Well, just in time for Black Friday, KPCW's Roger Goldman spoke with University of Utah marketing professor Alyssa Wu to help make sense of the earlier deals, shifting consumer behavior, and what retailers are really aiming for this season. Let's give that a listen.
The day after Thanksgiving has long been the official start of the holiday shopping season. Here to talk about how Black Friday, and indeed holiday shopping as a whole, has evolved in recent years is Professor Alyssa Wu of the David Eccles School of Business at the University of Utah. Good morning, Professor Wu, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Professor Wu, it seems that retailers are trying to move the holiday shopping season ever earlier. How widespread, in fact, is the actual retail season creep?
Well, this is a very interesting observation, and it's a real one, because holiday season creep is extremely widespread today. Almost every single major retailer now launches holiday promotions weeks before Thanksgiving.
And why do you think the retailers are pursuing that strategy?
Well, I see 3 reasons behind this trend. First of all, retailers want to smooth out the demand. Instead of having one massive spike on Black Friday, they try to spread sales over several weeks to reduce pressure on logistics and staffing. The second reason is really about getting a leg up on the competitors. Consumers have become more price sensitive when households are watching their budgets. Early deals help retailers capture those dollars before their competitors do. So launching promotions earlier isn't an accident. It's a deliberative strategy to lock in every early spending. And finally, it's simple. More time simply means more buying occasions for the customers, which usually results in more sales and higher profits. So stretching the timeline allows customers to start earlier, having more occasions to buy instead of compressing everything into one weekend.
And how early, in fact, are we seeing promotions of what we would traditionally call a Black Friday sale? How early are we seeing them broadcast? Is anything happening like before Halloween even?
Yeah, well, according to reports, there are sales around mid-October, if not earlier.
Okay, and historically, you know, if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, Black Friday was synonymous with the concept of a doorbuster. And the local, you know, or the national morning shows would feature pictures of people lined up outside of a department store, just waiting to go in and buy that what was not then a flat screen, but a TV set that was substantially marked down and competing like crazy to get it. How important was it for retailers to get into the store?
Remember when people lined up outside Best Buy at 4 a.m. in the morning just to buy a $1.99 TV? So in the past, the doorbusters were crucial. If a retailer could get customers inside the store at 4 a.m., they're confident that the customers would buy multiple items instead of just a TV set. But with online shopping, consumers no longer need to physically show up for deals. E-commerce platforms can offer the same markdowns, if not better discounts, without the lines.
So they have to do something else. What are they? They still want to get the consumer into the store, because if you get them in, they're likely to buy more stuff. So what do they do now to get them into the stores?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because instead of viewing online versus offline as competitors, best practice retailers treat them as complementary channels. This is because consumers are different, and consumers have diverse needs and wants that can be satisfied by different channels. For example, some consumers prefer online because of convenience, wide selection, price comparisons, and home delivery, especially in places like Park City, where winter shopping in person can be tricky for some customers sometimes. Whereas other customers prefer offline because they feel like they like to have the touch and feel, the in-store experience, the holiday decorations, or the incidental purchase, and many more. That's why we see so many holiday movie scenes filmed inside of the department stores. The physical experience is just a part of the magic. So today we see things like buy online, pick up in store, or browse in store, buy later online. So the goal isn't to choose one specific channel, is to really reach different kinds of customers via different ways.
Your observation about the holiday movies, it makes me smile, because at times I've wondered whether it was like a conspiracy between Hallmark and the big retailers to sort of romanticize the notion of holiday shopping in this day and age. You know, I remember, I gotta say again, it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the Park City Outlet Mall was open on Thanksgiving at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think this was fairly widespread. I personally found it rather distasteful for the poor retail employees who would have to wolf down their turkey. I don't think it was a good idea, but it disappeared. What can you say about why that happened?
Your memory is absolutely correct. In the mid-2010s, many major retailers opened on Thanksgiving evening or even earlier to capture those early deals. Sometimes they call it a Black Thursday. However, opening on Thanksgiving became unpopular very quickly. For example, Target announced that they wouldn't open on Thanksgiving Day in 2021 and beyond. Likewise, Best Buy confirmed that its stores would remain closed on Thanksgiving in upcoming years. And this is because the retailers didn't actually see much financial benefits from opening on Thursday. It just put Friday customers into Thursday. And also there was public criticism regarding family time on Thanksgiving, and employees pushed back as well. Especially during the pandemic, the retailers had to close on Thanksgiving because out of necessity, but consumers didn't mind at all. So many companies realized they could restore the holiday for their employees and customers without really sacrificing anything.
And, you know, going back to something we touched on before, I know that watching football this weekend, I was repeatedly reminded by Walmart that Black Friday is not a day, it's a week. And I think Amazon is doing something similar. Is that, again, another technique to try to stretch it out that is being employed on a widespread basis?
Exactly. This ties back to our discussion earlier. The whole holiday season is stretching. When companies like Walmart or Amazon call it Black Friday week, they're really trying to own the whole conversation. By stretching it out, retailers create multiple opportunities to attract the different customers. It also reduces the pressure on their supply chain because their fulfillment centers don't have to handle stressful peak traffic anymore. It offers marketing advantages as well. So Amazon, Walmart, and other retailers realized that consumers oftentimes don't want a chaotic 48-hour spring rate anymore. They want time to browse, compare, and wait for the right deal. And retailers want multiple opportunities to grab customers' attention. So when Amazon runs Black Friday Deals Week, it's not a gimmick. It's a way to keep customers engaged for longer, reduce shopping crunches, and capture those early shoppers.
Now, as I understand it, the term Black Friday traditionally referred to the notion that it was when certain retailers would actually begin to show a profit for the entire year. How important is the holiday shopping season for retail profitability?
Mm-hmm. I think the retail season is still super relevant and hugely important. According to a report by Census Bureau, they indicated that the retail spending in December 2024 alone exceeded $600 billion. It's about $1,766 per person. And many retailers make a significant share of their profits in November and December every year. Anywhere really between 20 to 30%, of course, depending on the product category, but we have to admit that its dominance has softened a bit because shopping now, like we mentioned, starts earlier, sometimes as early as October. The holiday spending is more diffused across the fourth quarter of the year. So I would say the season is still critical, but the pressure is less concentrated on a single weekend like it used to be.
You know, in this conversation, we've touched a couple times on the big retailers like Amazon and Walmart. In the current environment, is this year expected to be a robust spending year?
This year looks, I would say, cautiously optimistic. Because I read a report published by Visa. It's a holiday spending outlook. It indicates that holiday sales are forecasted to rise about 4.6% this year. So that looks healthy, but I would say a lot of that growth may reflect higher prices because of inflation rather than people buying more items. So inflation also means people may shift toward more practical gifts or smaller luxuries rather than large ticket luxury items. So consumers are still spending, but they're more deliberate. We hunt for deals, compare prices online, and focus on value rather than splurging.
And that was something I wanted to ask you about. Between inflation and tariffs, is the season expected to be somewhat shifted more toward, you know, durables, clothing, useful things that you might otherwise do anyway, rather than sort of the frivolous kinds of purchases that we see in those Hallmark movies?
I believe so. And tariffs is another very interesting topic because tariffs could raise prices in categories like electronics or clothes, and that can lead to either delayed consumption from the customers or a move toward cheaper alternatives. But overall, I think we still expect a strong holiday season. At the end of the day, it's a holiday season, and we as consumers would love to buy gifts to celebrate our loved ones or even reward ourselves. It's just a one season where shoppers are going to be more strategic and deliberative.
Okay, are you planning to do some holiday shopping this afternoon?
Yeah, for sure. For my dogs.
All right, Professor Alyssa, well, anything you want to talk about before we go?
I think that's all.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Well, the PC Mark has a full slate of seasonal programs ready to go. KPCW's Roger Goldman caught up with the Mark's Recreation Division Manager, Jessica Moran, to walk us through what's happening this December.
The holidays are not just a time for excessive eating and drinking. It's a great time to get a jump on those fitness goals you might want to meet in the new year. Here to talk about programming at the Mark this holiday season is Jessica Moran. She is the Recreation and Division Manager at the Mark. Good morning. Thanks for joining me, Jessica.
Good morning.
So, Jessica, for what kind of programming are you looking at for the Mark over the holiday season?
We've got some pretty exciting programs on the docket. We have some things for kids, of course. I think it would be great to mention our gingerbread builders class.
Okay, you have to tell me what that is.
Yeah.
It's making me hungry this Friday morning.
Those little engineers can come build the gingerbread mansion of their dreams. This is Friday, December 12th. For kids around ages 5, but we'll take them up to 18. Anyone who wants to come be creative, can join that class. We do community crafts every month, and for the month of December, we're building gingerbread houses.
And do you have to bring your own gingerbread? How does it work?
No, we'll supply everything that they need. Mm-hmm. All they need to bring is their imagination.
And does that typically sell out?
It does.
Okay, yeah, so when is registration open now?
Registration for all the classes and clinics and things that I'm going to talk about today is open currently.
Okay. And that one sounds like fun. I bet. Are there pictures from last year up on the website?
We do have some photos that we have put up on our flyers and on the website. So we hope people will join us and check that out.
Are there prizes?
I don't know if there are prizes. That's a great question. There should be.
So there's certainly a prize in that you get to take the gingerbread house home and eat it, I assume.
Yes, we will send them home with their gingerbread creation and candy high, probably.
Okay. And now, another thing that you mentioned as we were getting ready to start the interview was something involving flashlights.
Yes, our flashlight candy cane hunt is scheduled for Friday, December 19th, and this is for the littles, ages 3 to about 8 years old. Imagine a nighttime Easter egg hunt, but holiday-themed and way more magical. The kids show up with mom or dad, and they hunt for candy canes in the dark with their headlamp, their flashlight, whatever they want to bring. And, you know, the last couple of years, we've had a surprise guest at the flashlight candy cane hunt. So we don't want to talk about it too much, just in case, but I have a good feeling that he'll return this year.
And is that indoors or outdoors?
You know, we imagine it will be indoors this year at the Mark, and we'll hold that in the gymnasium.
Of course, given the weather right now, it might be outdoors.
Yeah, you never know. You never know.
And again, is that another event that tends to sell out?
You know, we can really take quite a few kids in that, and we want everyone to join. So I would say to sign up sooner than later, just in case.
Okay. And what about for those of us who are not so young and are interested in fitness issues during the holiday season to offset the excessive caloric intake? Well, are you offering any special programs or will the regular programs be going on as well?
We'll have regular programs going on. Of course, our group fitness classes are scheduled weekly. Cycling, yoga, strength classes, all of that is on a regular schedule at the Mark. And so we welcome everybody to come in and, you know, get rid of some of those extra calories. We will do a fitness challenge at the start of the year to get everyone up and off to a good start with their New Year's resolutions as well. So more info to come on that.
Well, historically, the gyms are packed that first week in January and the second week in January, and then seems to drift off a little bit.
Yeah, hopefully we can do something to encourage, you know, involvement throughout the month and maybe throughout the year.
Okay. And again, you sort of went quickly through the sort of range of classes. For those who aren't all that familiar, and we may have some visitors in town right now, can you talk a little bit more about the range of programs that are available at the Mark and the range of fitness options?
Sure. And I think it would be helpful to say, since you mentioned visitors, that we are a public facility, so everyone is welcome. You don't have to have a membership to come to the Mark. You can pay a daily rate, or we do sell passes as well. But we offer a variety of fitness classes that take place there's a big schedule, and it's available on our website at parkcityrecreation.gov. So people can view that there. And then in addition to, you know, the weight room and the running track and the group fitness classes and the cardio equipment, we also hold some other programming that is maybe more for the mental sense than the physical sense. So I can give you some details on that as well.
Okay.
A couple of those include our ski and snowboard waxing workshops. And we've got three coming up in the month of December, the 4th, the 10th, and the 16th. These are for ages 14 plus. And I will say that my teenager participated last year, and he's got his own waxing workshop set up in our garage right now, just patiently waiting for the snow. So while we're all waiting for that, this is a chance to bring in your equipment and get yourself set up with a perfectly tuned setup for smoother turns all throughout the season and, you know, learn a little bit while you're at it.
Wait, I have to stop you. How good a job did he do on your skis last season?
He did a great job on my snowboard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he took my snowboard and his own set of skis, and it was great. So I think it's something exciting for them to learn and then, you know, really just brush up on your skills. Our instructor hails from Vermont and worked in a ski shop there where she tuned skis, you know, for many, many years at a very high level for a lot of racers and people that were competing. So we've got some good knowledge to share.
That is a quintessentially Park City thing to do, to have a ski waxing class. Okay, mm-hmm. Other classes.
We have our avalanche awareness classes that we put on every year with the Utah Avalanche Center. And this year we're actually offering one specifically for teens on December 15th. So we would like to invite them to come. These classes are free. And it's just a great opportunity to gain some knowledge to help you feel a little bit more safe when you get out there in the snow. We also have another one that's open to everyone to participate on December 18th as well. And again, those are free, but we do encourage registration for them on our website. And then the other one that we're doing is a winter ready wilderness first aid clinic. And we really offer these wilderness first aid clinics on a monthly basis. We work closely with Courtney Llewellyn from Traverse Beyond, who has a wealth of knowledge and is a certified instructor through SOLO, Stonehearth Open Learning Opportunities. And this clinic is a 2-hour sort of go back to the basics, right? And we tailor them to the sports that Parkites just love. And this one will get anyone who's interested in fat biking or snowshoeing or winter camping, backcountry skiing, just a good chance to get some really valuable information to keep yourself and your friends safe while you're out there.
For some parents who might be listening to this, the idea of having some place to have your kids out of the house during the holidays might be attractive. Got any camps in mind?
We do, of course. Our winter break camp still has availability the week of December 22nd. So that's Christmas week. We will offer that camp on Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. We'll take Christmas Eve and Christmas Day off. And there's still space available. That camp is really fun because it's like all the fun field trips that you did at school all at one time. So the plans currently, which they could change depending on weather and things, but they will visit the Living Planet Aquarium, the Hangtime Adventure Park, Tracy Aviary. So we really get them out and get them, you know, doing some fun stuff so mom and dad can have some time.
You're making me sorry that I'm too old to come.
We should do an adult version, too.
And that one does tend to sell out as well.
Yeah. In fact, the second week through New Year's is sold out already and has a wait list going. But we still have availability for that first week. So I would jump on as soon as possible. And then I should also mention that our February break camp is open for registration now as well. And so that one may sell out also. And again, if people are interested, we just encourage them to get on and get the information and get registered.
And once again, what's the age range for those camps?
So those camps run from about 5 to 12 years old.
Okay. All right. Any other sort of activities that we should highlight for the month of December?
For the month of December, I would say that we've covered just about everything, but we just have a multitude of things happening all the time at the Mark. And so I want to encourage people to get on our website, parkcityrecreation.gov, and check out everything that we have to offer. And if you've never been to the Mark, you know, the new year is a good time to get started.
And you mentioned before that it is a public facility. What are the sort of the day pass options for visitors or for people who aren't members?
Oh, you're going to test me
yes,
on the prices here. year. So we offer both a visitor and a resident daily drop-in. And with that daily drop-in, you get access to the weight room, the fitness floor, the running track, the basketball gymnasium, locker room, steam rooms. We also offer group fitness classes that you can do a daily drop-in for, as I mentioned earlier. We get a lot of participation in yoga classes and cycling classes for visitors who maybe don't want to be on the hill all the time. And then we also offer monthly passes for both visitors and residents, of course, as well as 3, 6, 12-month passes. And you can get them for just the facility or for group fitness classes as well.
And the current pricing of those is available on the website?
It is available on
so
the website.
So I'm not going to try to stump you.
That would be great. Okay. I do know that the resident fee to drop in just for a day is $10. Right. So
quite reasonable.
Hard to beat it.
Okay, Jessica Moran, thanks for joining us on this Black Friday.
You're very welcome. It's nice to see you.
We'll be right back after this.
Let's check in one more time with some local news. Despite low snowfall, early season avalanches can happen. KPCW's Sydney Weaver reports the Utah Avalanche Center is trying to get ahead of the slides.
The Utah Avalanche Center has already received its first reported avalanche of the season. The November 23rd slide in Little Cottonwood Canyon was more than a foot deep and about 150 feet wide. UAC Executive Director Caroline Miller says even in the early season, it's crucial to check snow and avalanche reports before heading out.
Even when it seems like there's not much snow down in the valley floors or in our yards, there is some snow up in the hills on various aspects, and that can lead to a variety of outcomes once more snow comes.
The center offers daily avalanche forecasts spanning the state throughout the winter. 7 years ago, the Utah State Legislature passed a bill designating the first week of December as Avalanche Awareness Week. Miller says the UAC will host events across the state, including Park City, to raise awareness. The kickoff party is December 1st at Sugar House Park. Awareness manager Liam McDonald says some furry friends will join the party.
We'll also have a light flight helicopter in the park. We'll have stations to practice with your beacon and some wilderness medicine skills.
The UAC will open the Pinebrook Beacon Park December 4th for people to test their beacons before heading out to the backcountry. The following week, the UAC and Know Before You Go will host a free hour-long awareness class at White Pine Touring. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
That is your local news hour for today. If you missed any portions of the show, you can catch these interviews online on KPCW later today.